I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Before he was killed, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was in the midst of organizing a nationwide movement for economic justice. 50 years later, activists are picking up where he left off. Today, local and national leaders of a new Poor People's Campaign join us to discuss Kansas City's role in the movement. Then we meet the metro's most prominent civil rights attorney. Arthur Benson has prosecuted employment discrimination, police misconduct, and voting rights cases, but he's most known for the Kansas City school desegregation case. We'll hear about his career on Up to Date after this hour's news.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share.
10 days ago, nearly 90 people were arrested in Missouri's capital as part of a nonviolent protest against poverty, racism, and other issues. The protesters sat in a downtown Jefferson City street and refused to leave as part of the Poor People's Campaign protests across the country, including in Kansas. If the name Poor People's Campaign might ring a bell, it should. Back in 1968, Martin Luther King helped organize an effort by that name in a bid to gain economic justice for poor people across the country. Now we're witnessing a revival. But how significant is this? Are we witnessing the beginning of something big? We're about to find out. With us today, the Reverend Liz Theo Harris is co-chair of the National Poor People's Campaign. She's also co-director of the Caro Center for Religious Rights and Social Justice. Liz, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
Bridget Hughes is a McDonald's worker and a leader in the local arm of the Fight for $15 Minimum Wage, and that group is linked to the Poor People's Campaign. Bridget, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
The Reverend Rodney Williams is also here. He's president of Missouri Faith Voices and senior pastor of the Swope Parkway United Christian Church. Reverend Williams, Rodney, nice to have you.
It's good to be here today.
Reverend Theo Harris, give us the history here. Shortly before he died, Martin Luther King Jr. was engaged in this original Poor People's Campaign. What was he trying to achieve?
Yeah, in December of 1967, he had called for this campaign. It was months after he had started to come out against the Vietnam War and the intersection between militarism and racism and poverty. And he said that if we could bring poor people together, and in that case, it was to Washington, D.C., to kind of take action together to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience, that this would be a kind of wake-up call for the nation. And so he proposed bringing 3,000 poor people from about, you know, at least 10 of the poorest communities across the country, and to stay in D.C. until, you know, real changes that uplifted people were met. And, you know, he connected different struggles that were taking place across the country. You know, he was in Memphis in April of 68 when he was assassinated. Mm-hmm. He was there because sanitation workers were on strike, and that struggle of sanitation workers, a struggle that, you know, saw a clear intersection between racism and poverty, was front and center in the Poor People's Campaign.
Reverend Williams, how is the Poor People's Campaign different today? Because King's campaign was focused on poverty, anti-militarism, and race, as we just heard Liz say. But you've added a fourth pillar here. Do I have that right?
Yes, you have.
And what is it?
And that fourth pillar is ecological denigration.
The environment.
The environment. And the reason for that is because in many of our minority communities, they are experiencing and being hit very hard with this issue, such as Flint, Michigan. Mm-hmm. In Flint, Michigan, as of today, people still can't drink tap water because of the contamination of lead that's in their system. We have coal miners in West Virginia that go to work every day, and their jobs is what's making them sick. They don't earn enough money to straight out buy health insurance. They don't qualify for Medicaid, and so therefore they find themselves in what we call between a rock and a hard place.
Right.
And so that is a major emphasis that we have within the Poor People's Campaign on today.
You know, Bridget Hughes, you personify the new face of this push. Tell us about your cause, which is the fight for a $15 minimum wage. Where is that?
The Fight for 15 and a union movement is joining the Poor People Campaign because we also are fighting for a living wage and equality on our jobs, and the union, which will give us the security on our jobs. And this is the same thing that we're seeing even 50 years ago when Dr. King stood with the sanitation workers. We're still seeing those problems today. The racism and the economic injustice and the militarism is still continuing on today. So we know that we need to get all of our working people together to fight back.
You work full-time at McDonald's?
Yes.
And how much do you make an hour?
I make $9.50 an hour. And my husband also works a low-wage job where he makes $9.50 an hour. And even with both incomes, we struggle to meet. So I definitely feel like $15 is more than reasonable.
How would that change your life?
Me personally, I would be able to go to work with a smile on my face. I wouldn't be coming home stressed, finding no food in the refrigerator for the kids, or disconnection of lights, or figuring out how I'm going to rub pennies together to pay the rent this month. It definitely would give me a little more security. It would not make us rich by any means. According to MIT, the living wage for Kansas City for one child and one adult is $24 an hour.
And that's what you guys are.
Correct. So 15 is more than reasonable.
And so you're making less than that, even you and your husband combined.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, where does the fight for a higher minimum wage stand today? Because I know the Missouri legislature hasn't been helpful on this front because it passed a law that said cities like Kansas City can't set its own minimum wage that differs from the statewide minimum wage.
Correct. And this is another reason why we need to continue to fight and continue to participate in things such as civil disobedience, because we need to let them know that it's not fair that they're attacking workers' rights or they're attacking civil rights.
And you want to let them know that you're not going away.
Correct. We're not going away. We're not going to give up. This is something that we believe is good for all workers, whether you're immigrant or native born, regardless of what race you are. And it's not fair that we continue to get these gains and yet our state legislator takes those away from us.
Liz, the Poor People's Campaign lost momentum after Dr. King's assassination. Why did it flag in those days? Was it simply because it had lost its leader?
Well, I think that, you know, when Dr. King was assassinated, much of the vision, but then the early connections that were making up the campaign were assassinated as well. So, you know, just 2 weeks before his death, was the first meeting of what was called the Minority Leaders. And this was a group of you know, poor organizations from different walks of life in different areas. You know, there were indigenous groups present. There were Puerto Rican and Chicano. There were Appalachian white organizations and urban and southern, you know, black groups. And you know, this, you know, Dr. King says in this meeting, again, 2 weeks before he's killed, that he's never been in a meeting like this. And so those connections, those relationships were just being made. And so, you know, they were still, there's a lot of work to be done to
right.
be able to pull together. And so I think that had a lot to do with why more wasn't able to be accomplished. And yet we also need to celebrate the accomplishments of the campaign. I mean, programs like Head Start, you know, have its roots in the Poor People's Campaign.
So today, Liz, who's behind the push to revive the Poor People's Campaign now?
Well, I mean, there are thousands of grassroots leaders.
But who started it? I get that. But who is the initiating force?
So this phase of the campaign, the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, has been kind of called for by the Cairo Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice, the organization I'm a part of,
right,
as well as Repairers of the Breach, organization that was started and is led by Reverend Dr. William J. Barber, the second out of North Carolina,
okay,
as well as some other groups. So.
And why today? Why 50 years later? What's brought us to this moment that you guys are launching this campaign again now?
Well, I mean, I think if we look at how conditions are today, there are 140 million poor and low-income people in the United States. That's 43.5% of the population. 80% of Americans at some point in our lives experience economic hardship, not being able to make our ends meet. We have fewer voting rights today than we did 50 years ago, even though people, you know, died for those rights. I mean, when you were just talking about, you know, these living wage and a minimum wage ordinances, you know, there are 25 states that have refused to give minimum wage increases that the cities and towns have called for, the people have called for. And this is connected to, you know, deep voter suppression and
right.
Systemic racism. And so, you know, today these conditions are in so many ways even worse than they were 50 years ago. And so I think where the call for this campaign has come has been from grassroots leaders, from poor people's organizations
right.
all across this country.
Let me
saying,
ask this,
you know,
Rodney.
The time is up.
Let me ask this, Rodney. What's taken so long? Because we've been hearing stories about this growing disparity in this nation between rich and poor for years. We hear all the time about tax cuts that benefit the wealthy. Democrats just complained about exactly that with tax cuts that passed the Missouri General Assembly just last week. So why haven't we seen more protests before now? What's taken you so long?
I think there has been work going on throughout communities across America ever since Dr. King was assassinated. I think what has happened is...
But not like this.
Not like this. I think this is the appropriate and the proper time. I think people have their backs up against the wall and they've become fed up. And so now people are organizing, galvanizing together because we realize that racism is still alive in America. We realize that voter suppression is alive in America. We realize that there are so many inequities that are taking place in America today that we are at a point where we have no other choice but to rise up right now.
Bridget, from your standpoint, is this overdue?
This is more than overdue. We see with the Fight for 15 that we were already protesting and coming together against these issues. But it's definitely overdue for the Poor People campaign. I am more than proud to be a part of this campaign. But we definitely did pick the right time to address these issues, especially with the increasing social media of racism.
Mm-hmm.
The
social media helps here.
Correct.
So does the anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, right? 50
correct.
Years ago last month. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's when we launched the Poor People's Campaign back in February, was on that anniversary of the original date.
Yeah.
I definitely think that it's more than overdue, but we did pick the right time to continue that legacy.
Liz, do you think it's taken too long here?
Well, I mean, I think that this time is up. I mean, we can talk about what should have been and what people have actually been doing. But I think what we've found traveling across this country, you know, from El Paso, Texas to Aberdeen, Washington to Lowndes County, Alabama, we've found that people are ready and they're moving. And what we've seen now over the past 2 weeks in terms of the being in the middle of these 40 days of nonviolent moral fusion direct action, people engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience, you know, in state capitals all across this country, I think we see the kind of rise of, you know, a really important budding kind of movement.
And our listeners can expect this movement to continue to grow and to see activities, what, throughout the rest of this year, next year, Liz?
So right now, starting on May 14th, we launched these 40 days of action, and those are taking place, you know, again, in about 36 state capitals and in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. will have a big mass mobilization in Washington, D.C. on June 23rd. But the purpose of that event, you know, on the 23rd will be to send folks back to our states, back to our communities to keep, you know, deep dive organizing and movement building. And so there will be lots more activities and actions taking place, you know, past these 6 weeks of action that we're in right now.
The Reverend Rodney Williams, you know, this campaign is organized on a national level, as Liz just said, but she's also referred to regional and state chapters. How many state chapters are there in Kansas and Missouri? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't have any sense of how many state chapters there are, but what I can tell you
is... But they are in Kansas and Missouri.
Kansas and Missouri, we have thousands of people, people of faith, people of non-faith, coming together to support this campaign, because as has just been stated, that the time is now and we are not going to go anywhere. And after the 40-day campaign is over, we will be continuing the work that we have started with deeper organizing throughout our states.
You know, can you tell us a little bit more, Rodney, about what the Missouri chapter has been doing or the Kansas City area and what it's been concerned about? I know the Kansas chapter recently staged a protest at Secretary of State's Chris Kobach's office. 14 people got arrested. You all were recently in Jeff City. What else has been going on?
We've been in Jeff City for the past 2 weeks. The first week, 88 people were arrested as a result of providing civil disobedience. The emphasis on that particular week was the fact that we have women and children that are in poverty. And as long as women and children are in poverty, America is in trouble. So we were standing against poverty. Last week when we went because of systematic racism. Racism is still alive. We still have poor immigrant policies where ISIS is taking people, ripping their families apart. And we were standing against that.
How is your fight for race? How can you be effective protesting racism?
We can be effective protesting racism because of what we believe is that this particular movement is a moral compass, because Missouri as well as America has fallen into a moral crisis, and we are the moral compass to help them to realize. And so our job is to help change the consciousness of America, to help people see, to know that when we're doing politics, we have to have a conscience about the politics in which we're doing, and that it is the job of the state to take care of the welfare of the people.
If you're just joining us, we're talking this morning about the new Poor People's Campaign. Liz, are the issues here in Kansas City the same as issues elsewhere across the country?
Well, I mean, I think that there's different ways that they manifest in Kansas City, but what we have found, again, traveling across this country, is that, you know, there is widespread and deep poverty and low wages. There's widespread and deep racism and voter suppression. There's widespread and deep, you know, ecological devastation with, you know, 4 million homes, when they turned down their taps this morning, had poisoned water, poisoned by lead coming out. I mean, so that this is, you know, this isn't happening in just one community, and it isn't happening just amongst one group of people. But these problems are really are impacting so many people. And that's why people are coming together with real concrete demands, you know, of affordable housing, of affordable and clean water, of living wages, including Fight for 15 and the right to form and join unions.
Liz, how is Donald Trump's presidency affecting the direction of the new Poor People's Campaign?
So we had called for this campaign before Donald Trump was even elected. And folks had been organizing for it for many, many years, in fact. But what Donald Trump seems to you know, offer or represent in some ways, I think, is a deeper kind of moral malady that is wreaking havoc on our nation. And so in the 2016 presidential election, for instance, in those 25 or 26 debates that took place, not one of them took up the real issues of poverty and living wages, of voter suppression, of universal single-payer health care. And so, you know, what we're seeing is that when our politicians don't have to focus on the issues that affect the majority of people the majority of the time, then we end up in situations like we are in now. And so that's why people are coming forward. And I do think, you know, many people have been struggling and organizing and fighting for a long time, and new people are joining the fight now because they're being impacted as well, and they're seeing that this nation could be better.
Bridget Hughes, our McDonald's worker here on our panel. How does Donald Trump energize the movement? How does he affect it?
His words against people of color or people who are not immigrant, people who are not native born to America, somehow saying that this country will suddenly be great again if we somehow get rid of those people. It's definitely hurtful to someone like me. I come from a blended family. I love, you know, the idea of getting to know different cultures. And I feel like anyone who works in the richest nation in the country should not be forced to live in poverty, whether they're gay, straight, white, black, brown, immigrant born, native born. It shouldn't matter. If you're working full time in the richest nation in the world, you don't deserve to live in poverty, despite what our president may feel.
Liz, just a final point. Your campaign began on May 14th. It's set to run for 40 days. Why 40 days, Liz?
Well, 40 days is, you know, a significant number, you know, throughout history, throughout sacred traditions. It also was how long the Resurrection City that the 1968 Poor People's Campaign was set up for. And so it's a season, you know, 40 days represents 6 weeks. A lot can happen in 40 days. And we also wanted it to be a specific amount of time so that then we could go back, evaluate, dig deeper in our communities, and launch the next phases of the campaign.
Rodney Williams, how can people connect with the Poor People's Campaign here in the Metro?
The people can connect with the Poor People's Campaign here in the Metro by getting on our website, poorpeoples.org. We are having several events that are taking place on May 21st. We're going to have an event that takes place. We're going to have an event that takes place on May 29th. So every week, every Monday, there's going to be an event taking place. But the big event is taking place on June the 11th, where we're going to have labor and many different groups out, and we're inviting you to come. But all you have to do is contact poorpeoples.org, poorpeoplescampaign.org.
That's the Reverend Rodney Williams. He's president of Missouri Faith Voices and a senior pastor at Swope Parkway United Christian Church. Reverend, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
The Reverend Liz Theo Harris is co-chair of the National Poor People's Campaign. Liz, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Bridget Hughes is a McDonald's worker. She's part of the local Fight for $15 minimum wage campaign. Bridget, thank you very much as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit with Arthur Benson, the lawyer who became famous for his work in the Kansas City school desegregation case. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we spoke with historian John Meacham about the legacy of partisan divide in American government. You can hear that conversation and others at kcur.org/up-to-date. We're taking Memorial Day off, but we'll return on Tuesday to discuss how white people can be supportive allies in the pursuit of racial equality and social justice. So say the words Arthur Benson in this town, and a certain segment of the population knows exactly who you're talking about. Arthur Benson was the lead attorney in Kansas City's now famous, or even infamous, school desegregation case back in the 80s and 90s. Benson's work reshaped the school district and fortified it with a series of new buildings, but the goal of attracting a solid core of white students and setting the district on a new winning path never materialized. Arthur Benson also was engaged in litigation involving Planned Parenthood and civil rights cases, including one recent high-profile case where Kansas City police arrested a Lawrence man for asking a provocative question about Israel at a public library event. Arthur Benson is here to look back and look ahead, and so nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning.
How did you get involved in the school desegregation case to begin with, Arthur? How did that happen?
I guess I was somewhat known as a civil rights lawyer at the time, and the plaintiff's school children were being represented by the same lawyers who represented the school district, and the court said that was a conflict of interest and said the kids needed their own independent lawyer. So their parents, who were Presbyterian minister, social activist here in Kansas City engaged me to take over the case.
You know, back in those days, you had been advocating publicly for an interstate school desegregation solution. That would have been in the 70s when you were general counsel for the ACLU in Western Missouri. What was that interstate school solution you were looking at? I mean, would this have involved Kansas?
Yes. In fact, the lawsuit that was originally filed by the school district that I later took over the representation of the children sued both the states of Missouri and Kansas, sued school districts on both sides of the state line, and sued federal agencies with jurisdiction on both sides of the state line.
Sued them for what?
For their role in segregating the Kansas City, Missouri school district. By the time I was in the case, the Kansas defendants were out. But what is little known, and many of us who are of a certain age remember, that if you lived in Prairie Village and were of high school age before Shawnee Mission East opened, you almost always went to Southwest High School.
Oh, you're kidding. I didn't know that.
You had to provide your own transportation, but it was free because it was the closest high school. Shawnee Mission then was what the only school is what is now Shawnee Mission North, and the parents in Mission Hills and Prairie Village strongly preferred Southwest because it was a preeminent high school in the nation at the time.
This was interesting to me. Back at that time, the husband of a school board member approached you and asked you to represent the school children. Your reaction, I'm quoting here, "I was so excited, I couldn't sleep." You said that at the time. Why were you so excited?
Well, I went to law school to be a civil rights lawyer, and this case just kind of came to me.
This is right in your wheelhouse.
That's why I was a lawyer then and still am.
Did you have any idea what you were getting yourself into?
I didn't think that I would be. I ended up being officially in that case for 3 months shy of 25 years. I had no idea it was going to last that long. I knew it was a major, important case, but...
What kind of shape were the schools in those days on the Kansas City side? Describe them to us.
Oh, it was terrible. The schools were in such horrible physical shape that some schools, including Southwest, the front doors had to be chain closed because the doors wouldn't fit together within the frames. There were places where when it rained, they put buckets in the classrooms to collect the water. There were rooms where during the winter the boilers didn't work and the kids had to wear their winter coats. I can remember taking Landon Rowland at that time at Kent City Southern and some other businessmen on the tour of a particular elementary school, which was later demolished in the desegregation program. And the grown men and women came out of that tour wiping tears out of their eyes saying it's a sin that we are trying to educate kids in such abysmal places. The smell of urine permeated the building because even though the janitors cleaned the bathrooms every day, the floors were in such bad shape that they could not be completely sanitized. And then in the winter, you turn the heat on and the smell just permeated the building. It was ghastly.
You know, in those early days, Arthur, you worked with an army of lawyers. They included law students and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. It was 18 hours a day and most weekends. Was that a blast or was it simply too much work?
It was not too much work. I mean, it was thrilling.
Thrilling because?
Well, we were working on an important case. We were creating, in an essence, a history of race relations and segregation in Western Missouri that went back into the 1870s, and we were finding older survivors of many of the racist practices of the time who had experienced them in the 20s and 30s who were still alive in the 70s, and we were recording and interviewing them. And we ended up putting about 1 million pages of this history into the historic, it's now held by the Historical Society of Missouri.
You know, we're just an hour away from Topeka, and Brown versus Board of Education was based there back in the mid-50s. I thought that was supposed to resolve all these issues. And you're telling me something very different.
Well, Brown won in 1954 had no remedial component to it. And 2 years later—
Meaning?
meaning the courts didn't order school districts to do anything. They just said segregation is illegal.
So it was a nice statement, you're saying, but there wasn't a lot of teeth behind it.
2 years later in Brown 2, the courts finally said, you know, with all deliberate speed. But what does deliberate speed, you know, if you're in the South, deliberate means, you know, take your time. And if you're resistant to racial integration, you ended up having to be sued before you did anything. And so lawsuits were filed throughout the South, and they gradually worked their way north.
Civil rights lawyer Arthur Benson is my guest. You lost by a vote at the appellate court level, if I remember correctly, in your attempt to craft this city suburban desegregation remedy. How disappointing was that after all that effort?
Well, it was pretty disappointing.
We came close.
We lost by a tie vote. Yeah, the Judge Clark had denied an inter-district remedy, and on appeal by a 4-4 vote, it was affirmed. So we came close, but it would have been much more efficient and much less costly if we could have had a mandatory inter-district remedy.
Less costly for Kansas City, Missouri.
And the state of Missouri.
Oh, right. You would have spread the cost out, yeah.
Right. Missouri was paying about 2/3 of the cost, and Kansas City could not pay its 1/3 cost. And so the judge enjoined the statute that required a vote of the people so that the taxes could be raised by the school board and to fund the local share of the $2 billion cost.
I was going to say, after you lost that case, did you immediately pursue a remedy that would have just had the state of Missouri pay for it?
We had already been doing that because we lost it in the trial court, and we started developing the inter-district remedy that was voluntary rather than mandatory. And because by voluntary, we were creating magnet schools where we were attracting an integrated enrollment within the school district and from without the school district. And that was affirmed by the Supreme Court the first time we went there by a 5-4 vote with Justice Marshall on our side. And then 2 years later, it went back to the Supreme Court. Marshall had retired, replaced by Thomas, and by a 5-4 vote, they cut the remedy off. So our remedy had been fully implemented for only about 5 years, partially and wholly implemented for about 10 years. And during that time, we achieved more racial integration than any other metropolitan school district in the nation during those 10 years.
Describe that to us.
Well, it was all voluntary. And so the student essentially, to avoid using sort of anti-integration tools like magnet schools. Traditionally, a magnet school would be selected because it was all black, and you throw half the black kids out, and you spend more money to attract whites there, and that was doubly injurious to the black students. So, but we had to do a voluntary plan because the courts had not allowed us to do a mandatory plan, and John Ashcroft in the state of Missouri absolutely refused to go along with any mandatory plan.
Attorney general at that point, or governor?
Attorney general at that time. Mm-hmm. And so we developed a voluntary plan, but in order to avoid those kind of racist aspects of partially magnetizing, we magnetized the whole district so that every student would choose where he or she wanted to go, and you would get preference if your move caused some increase in racial integration. And so over time, over 6 years, we were in the process of implementing the full magnetization of the Kansas City School District. It was highly successful. And on the summer that the Supreme Court reversed its approval of our plan, we had 1,800 white students who had volunteered to come into the Kansas City School District from suburban school districts. So imagine this. They are giving up their home school, their neighborhood school, because they see a better opportunity in a magnet school in Kansas City. 1,800 of them from all around the Missouri side of the metropolitan area. And not only that, they were going into mostly black schools. And so it kind of put the lie to this old trope about a tipping point. I think our remedy has been used now sort of in the scholarly literature for 2 decades to prove that really there's no such thing as a tipping point, that it used to be argued that once a school district gets to a 35 or 40% black, all the whites will leave and you cannot stably integrate. We were integrating schools that were starting out at 96% black, and we were working them down at 2 to 4% per year by whites coming in, gradually integrating, showing that whites were not dissuaded by the so-called tipping point if you could have a superior educational right. opportunity at the end of the ride in from your neighborhood or your suburb.
You're talking about this concept of magnet schools a lot here. Remind us what magnet schools were, Arthur.
Magnet schools were specialty schools that would be open to the entire community. I mean, the nation has long had magnet schools. They're usually just been private. You know, Rockhurst, Pembroke, Pius X, they're all magnet schools. They attract from a wide geographic area. Within a public school system, you create some special attributes to a school. We'd always had Lincoln College Prep, which was a college prep magnet school. It just had not been funded until the desegregation program that funded it and made it highly successful. It's now ranked as one of the best high schools in the state of Missouri perennially. And so we Paseo became an arts school. Southwest became a math and science school. And at the elementary level, we did the same things. Highly popular and successful programs in full immersion French at Longan, which later kind of evolved into Academy Lafayette. There were a ton of those programs, which for about 10 or 12 years were highly successful, both as integrative models and as academic society.
So your point is it did work until the courts cut it off.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And they cut it off. Why?
Well, because the politics of the Supreme Court had changed. Marshall had retired and was replaced by Thomas. So our 5-4.
That's a big change.
Our five to four approval of our plan 1 year, 2 years later was disapproved and we were cut off and had to immediately phase the whole program down.
And the reason it was cut off, what did the courts say about why it had to go away?
They said the inter-district scope of the remedy, which it reached out into the suburbs with these voluntary incentives to attract integrative enrollments within the school district. They said that scoping into the suburbs exceeded the scope of the violation, which at that time was limited to the within the boundaries of the Kansas City School District.
You were using too big of a remedy to solve a very local problem.
Well, when the Supreme Court changed its mind and said that, true.
Mm-hmm. What impact did that ruling then have on the district?
Oh, it killed the program. It was allowed to phase out over about 4 years. The school district settled with the state of Missouri, for about $400 million, which kind of bankrolled the school district's budget for several years. But it was pretty rapidly drawn down. But one of the key things, the settlement that we, the plaintiffs, insisted be in the settlement, we said, if there's going to be a settlement, you need to secure this court-ordered tax increase, because the budget of the Kansas, if the remedy ended and the budget went back down to 1969 levels, they go bankrupt overnight. And so the state of Missouri agreed to put it on a ballot, and it amended the state constitution to freeze the levy at $5.97. It's the only levy in the nation that's a part of a state constitution. But it was sold by Ashcroft and others saying, vote yes on this and it will end this expensive DSEG program in Kansas City. And it did.
Again, my guest is Arthur Benson, the civil rights lawyer here in Kansas City. I was struck, again, in reading about all this, Arthur, that by the mid-1980s, you were flat busted broke as you were pursuing this case. More than that, you were more than $500,000 in the hole. And that's a lot of money. And I assume that was a lot of pressure, too.
You know, it could have been, but I was highly confident about the lawsuit, and so was the business establishment in Kansas City. People like, I mentioned Landon Roland, Irv Hockaday, and others, they co-signed my notes. I mean, I was $600,000 in debt, but they were at risk too. If we had lost the lawsuit and I never got a fee, never got a penny, I couldn't pay back $600,000.
You had support.
Yeah. The business community in Kansas City saw the advantage of
wanting to create a great school district.
And stabilize it in terms of its enrollment, its finances, and rebuild it. So when the program ended, we by far had every building in the district had either been renovated or replaced. Every building. We had by far the best physical plant of any school, metropolitan urban school district in the nation. We had secure financing because that levy was locked into the state constitution. And so the opportunity was there if the right leadership could come in. The big failing of the litigation was we could never convince the monitoring committee or the courts to get involved in personnel. And
what way?
What is wrong with urban education is we are building leadership among principals and classroom teaching was terrible, teachers were being hired and promoted based on their qualifications, how many degrees they had, irrespective of their effectiveness. And so towards the end, we were trying to turn that around and make all personnel decisions based on effectiveness, but the courts would never order that. They said, you know, personnel is beyond the sort of the ability of a federal judge to measure.
And yet today, this whole thing is regarded as an experiment that cost taxpayers $1 billion.
Two billion.
Thank you for correcting that. And it didn't work.
Well, that's wrong. It didn't work completely because we got cut off at the knees by the second Supreme Court. But a lot was done and learned in the process that could be useful. I mean, today, I think the school district is back in, I think, in 2010, it switched its personnel policies to make them all based on effectiveness, effective building leadership, effective classroom teaching. And I think that is helping.
But the district today isn't even accredited, not fully accredited.
Well, they're very close. But,
they're close, but that's not the whole thing.
And that's almost entirely due to the impact of poverty. I mean, we are a very poor school district, and there's a strong causal relationship between family income and educational outcomes. As Mayor Davis has made, I mean, sorry, as Mayor James has long made clear, and this is one of the things we were promoting in this litigation in 1993, is that kids come to school with highly differential vocabularies and reading skills, even in kindergarten. Some kids have a 7,000-word vocabulary, and others have 1,200.
That's why the mayor's pushing Turn the
right.
Page, the third-grade reading
right.
initiative.
Right. And we were pushing that in 1993, and we were buying books for families and stuff. And if you can get kids' brains just explode after birth, and they continue exploding until they hit puberty. But the best time to affect the educational outcomes are those 3 or 4 years between ages 1 and 5 before a kid comes to school. And much of the die is cast when they show up in preschool or kindergarten in high poverty, low achieving school districts. And that's where money best needs to be spent. And you know we. It's outside the jurisdiction of most public schools.
So as you sit here today, after so much of your career spent fighting for this district, after some years as a school board member itself, are you discouraged? Are you satisfied? What are you as you look back at this arc of your career spent on this school district?
You make it sound like it's ending.
Well, it's not. but
no, I both. I'm disappointed of all. It was just utterly devastating when we lost that second Supreme Court case and they just cut us off at the knees.
That was crushing.
Yeah, it was.
And you knew at that moment what that meant.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, we were on a very steep glide path to get out of the end of the program over the next 4 years as the money went down. But on the other hand, our achievements were really substantial. I mean, one of the things that we established, we had a demographer from Harvard who came in and was studying the program at the time it was ended, and he found that there was a statistically significant impact magnet schools made on integrated housing around elementary schools. That the white flight had leveled off, and there was some return, and you could spatially associate those geographically with magnet schools. We also had another guy from Columbia University who came in, and this is we were about to get an Annie Casey grant to further this study about the intergenerational effects of racial integration in public education. We found students who had been either in integrated or segregated education in the 50s and 60s in Kansas City, and we located them and we found their children, and we found first that those whose parents had been in integrated education in the 50s and 60s were more likely to have their kids in integrated education. But what was really fascinating was there was a statistically significant impact that those children of racially integrated parents did better in math. And it was not statistically significant in language arts. And the sample size was small. And we had to go to like Center and Hickman Mills to find a lot of these kids. But the intergenerational effects of racially integrated public school education, I believe, are profound. And we were just on the cusp of proving that.
Well, so you found solutions, but the court said you couldn't implement those solutions. So where are we?
Well, it's an,
if there's answers out there that can't be implemented, where are we?
You know, a community gets the public school system at once. And as it's disappointing that as a nation that we have written off so much of our brothers and sisters who live in urban areas, that we don't care enough to invest in them. And it's not just that. I mean, there are a lot of rural areas.
We spent $2 billion investing in them, and the court said you can't do it.
Well, the court said you can't do it, but there's no reason that we as citizens can't elect leaders and people do it. But, I mean, we're not doing it. We seem to be in retrograde now, I mean, which is very disappointing. We know the answers. There are people who know how to fix public education. They know that it's a mix of money and effective personnel. It takes both. In Kansas, they're talking about whether they want to spend $4,000 or $5,000 per kid. When I don't think you can reasonably, you cannot educate people for the 21st century in Kansas unless you're willing to spend about $6,000. And some school districts are going to need to spend more where they have the effects of low income. We are not close to addressing the problems with the solutions we have at hand.
That's Arthur Benson. He was a lawyer in Kansas City's famous school desegregation case. Thanks for coming in today. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
You bet. Yesterday, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian John Meacham discussed executive authority during critical moments in this country's history. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me, at Steve Kraske. Up to Date will take Monday off for the holiday, but will return on Tuesday to look at what a possible ownership change at NASCAR could mean for auto racing and for Kansas City, Kansas. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. Have a great long weekend, everybody. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.